Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The quality of the environment affects all living things, and the work of protecting and improving the quality of air and water is a shared responsibility. But when it comes to taking action, who decides what's a priority? How are everyone's needs addressed, or can they be? Later in the show, we'll hear how Blue Water Baltimore is celebrating 10 years of environmental engagement, education, and waterway restoration. First, we're joined by Fred Tutman, riverkeeper and CEO of Patuxent Riverkeeper. The nonprofit, which he founded in 2004, works to conserve, protect, and replenish Maryland's longest and deepest intrastate waterway. Tutman is among the longest-serving riverkeepers in the Chesapeake region and the only African-American riverkeeper in the United States. Welcome to the show, Fred.
Oh, glad to be here.
First, place the Patuxent River for us. Where does it flow?
So it runs north to south on the western shore of Maryland, above Howard County, roughly near the border, actually, of Howard County. It runs north to south to Solomons, where it meets the Chesapeake Bay, roughly about 110 miles long. It's a river that stays in Maryland. It starts in Maryland, and it pretty much terminates while still in Maryland as well. So some people even call it Maryland's River.
You have been riverkeeper for 17 years, but your history on the Patuxent goes back much further.
I was raised along the Patuxent River. My family still has a farm that my great-grandfather founded almost 100 years ago, right in walking distance of the Patuxent. So as a boy, I grew up playing in the streams that feed into the Patuxent, drafting water for our crops and hauling it to the farm from the Patuxent River, fishing in that river, very much a river guy as I was growing up.
And what does Patuxent Riverkeeper do?
So as riverkeeper, I'm an advocate, basically working to build a movement of water watchers and vigilant citizens up and down the course of the Patuxent. Essentially, we're running an organization that watchdogs the Patuxent to try and protect it from pollution, raise citizen vigilance, connect people around the theme of water protection, but also connect people, I think, spiritually to some extent to the river, only because I think people are passionate about any river that they happen to have personal ties to, and the Patuxent's no exception.
About 2 years ago, the Waterkeeper Alliance, a magazine, published an interview with you about your legacy as riverkeeper. And in it, you talked about the intersectionality of environment and race. You said that you, quote, drew from my own epiphany that after some 30 plus years of environmental work, simply acknowledging that race is important to the environmental cause was an important step, close quote. Unpack that for us.
Ironically, I am an African-American person of some privilege. Even though I'm from Maryland and was born and raised here, I've lived in other countries and have traveled quite a bit. And as a journalist, I've seen quite a lot of the world. So it really didn't occur to me that the environment was anything more than just the environment when I became a riverkeeper. It was when I began to pay attention to the conversations I was having about the environment in Black and brown communities compared to the ones in the Bay Movement or in whiter communities. I began to actually see a real disconnect between what people were talking about to their riverkeeper. So race became very relevant. It amazed me that I didn't really see that connection until well into adulthood and well into my 40s and well into being a waterkeeper. Right? How we see the environment, how we react to it, the conversations we have about the environment are entirely different based on our social lens, our circumstances. Those connections are all very different. And incidentally, different connections are, in fact, the soul of diversity, right? Diverse movements are movements that can accommodate lots and different points of view. So that's how I got into that frame of mind. Like, what is it we can do to try and build a unifying factor into these movements, given that the conversations and even the frame of reference for what the river's about is entirely different? It's not all one size fits all.
Well, for those of us who have not lived through that epiphany that you had, how would you summarize what the different approach is?
I mean, mind you, this is all through my lens. I don't know that I can say with any certainty what all people of color think or whatever. But what I do see is that it's very, very common for these movements that have a heritage of serving white communities and being supported by communities that are not communities of color. There's a tendency to look at the environment as a part of something connected to privilege, like sailing, crabs, oysters, things of that sort. And I'm not saying that people of color don't have an affinity for luxuries, but I am saying that it's much more common in Black and brown communities to link environmentalism to civil rights and lots of other things that maybe, if they're entitlements at all, they're ones that people have had to struggle for, had to fight for. I mean, that was certainly true in my case, even though I grew up next to the river. It's true that we didn't really have the same kind of access that, that people who were white did, or people who had money, or people who had privilege. It's not just race. And by the way, I actually think of race as kind of a mindset a lot of the time, too. It's impossible to be a river keeper and serve an entire watershed if you look at people in a binary sense. You're either Black or you're white. That's absurd. I actually think of it as a worldview. I actually think there is a culture associated with what people expect from an environmentalist. And I think the expectations are that environmentalists are white, which is astounding because there are lots of environmentalists and activists, environmental activists, to be found in Black and brown communities. I think how we talk about the environment and what we focus on and how we approach our environmentalism tends to be very, very different. And I'm not sure that message gets through at all.
That's Fred Tutman, founder and CEO of Patuxent Riverkeeper. We're talking about the effect race can have on prioritizing environmental issues here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. So play it out for me, how this epiphany you had, how has that shaped your work as Riverkeeper?
Well, I started actually pursuing ways to try and get deeper engagement from as many different communities and interest groups as I could in the watershed. We had an event at the office, at the Patuxent Riverkeeper offices. It was an annual party. And a person of color came up to me in the middle of the event, and she said, you know, I'm leaving because the whites talk to each other. And as though they know everything there is to know about the environment, they don't really want to hear what we have to say, we being people of color. And that troubled me, you know, as an African-American running an operation, an organization that wants to serve all comers. It bothered me that someone came to one of our events and didn't really feel included. And so I began to look at ways to include them. And so I had a jazz concert. It sounds like a cliche, but there were lots of people we had who were members of ours who were Black who said, you know, you should have a jazz concert. And then I got calls from whites who said, you know, you should have bluegrass, because it's really not fair that you would have jazz. Bluegrass is the only true type of music that you should be playing next to the Patuxent. I mean,
oh my goodness.
I know you can't win for losing. I mean, this told me, this was a part of the epiphany, is that whether it's jazz, classical, or whatever, that's diversity too. That if you go to next to the river and what you hear is bluegrass and banjos, that's fine. That's exactly what you hear through your lens. If you, on the other hand, hear straight ahead jazz when you watch the ripples in the water and, you know, take your inspiration from the environment, that's exciting too, because I do think these movements need all comers. We need jazz, we need classical, we need rock and roll, we need any form of diversity, any lens you can possibly find, because that's a durable movement. That's a movement that's going places because it's really set up to accommodate as many different points of view about the environment. And so that's really what we've been striving for. Anyway, the point is, I wrote this up in an article, and then I had people quit my board of directors as though I was trying to racialize the environmental movement. But what was intriguing was people of color contacted us and said immediately, literally the same day some people walked off our board, there were several people of color who said, you know, how do I get on your board? So it was a sign. It was a sign to me that we want to be a part of movements where we matter, where we want to be invested in these movements that serve the communities like the ones we live in. That there really isn't, like I said earlier, one size that fits all. We have to, as advocates, and frankly, as riverkeepers with an exclusive jurisdiction, that's a concept in our work. There is only one riverkeeper operation per watershed. It's especially important that one riverkeeper operation in whatever watershed be responsive and representative of as many different points of view as we possibly can.
You were honored at the Taking Nature Black conference this past February in Chevy Chase. What is Taking Nature Black about?
So Taking Nature Black is a brainchild of some folks at the Audubon Naturalist Society in Bethesda, and Patuxent Riverkeeper and other groups and individuals also partnered with Audubon Naturalist Society over the last couple of years. In fact, generally Taking Nature Black has been an event that is largely about the environment and social justice. And it is planned by, themed by, people of color. And we had one this year in February, and it was a fantastic event. I mean, again, we had people in the room from so many different walks. And again, the conversations were really rich, really powerful in terms of the scope of what people were talking about. It was so much broader than I had seen in meetings or conferences that were more homogenous. So again, the diversity changes the conversation. And I think that's what I think some of these organizations that say they want diversity, I think they struggle with that. They struggle with the idea that in order to get the diversity they want, or they say they want, they have to change. The organization has to change. I think the common paradigm is that they have to educate people of color, or that they have to change the messaging, because God goodness knows who wouldn't want clean water or clean air. I think the problem is that sometimes these organizations are not culturally competent to connect with people of color communities. And so it doesn't occur to them that those are lively places or likely places where they can get work done unless they change the community first. That's a disconnect. I think that's another of several disconnects that exist, or paradigms that exist within these big greens.
Do you see a shift on the part of environmental groups to be more inclusive and responsive to concerns and desires of Black communities?
It is, I believe, challenging for these organizations to review internally what it is about them that causes people of color to boycott them. That's what I think is really going on. It's not that we, as people of color, don't know about the environment or don't know how to champion it. It's, why would we join these organizations where we're an afterthought, where we are not really taken that seriously, except it reflects well on the organization. But the dividend for us is that we lose some of our own identity, some of our own context for the environment. It's a difficult conversation to have, because I'm not saying the underlying worth of these organizations is not great. They do wonderful work. I just don't think they do it necessarily in Black and brown communities, and I think they don't know where to start.
How do you see moving that along? You've been working at this for a long time already. What has to happen next?
I think we need to have better conversations, we being people generally, particularly in this country now where race is tearing us apart. We have to have better conversations amongst ourselves and become more skillful at how we talk about these differences in our perspective that sometimes can be easily resolved if we're skillful at how we resolve and approach problem solving. But I do believe, as long as there's a presumption that the environment is claim space, and that, again, people of color are footnotes, afterthoughts, we get to stand by and cheer. You know, those are not proportional movements, and they're not movements that I think can really speak for Black communities. I think that's an issue, too, that in some instances there's a presumption that these are communities that need guidance from these outside movements. And the truth is, every community we've ever encountered, Black, white, or indifferent, completely has the capacity to self-direct and set its own goals. And that's troublesome, I think, where we're funded to work on certain things, where the grant doesn't include social justice, but it does include clean water work. I mean, there's a lot of layers here. But I think it all gets clearer when we start having those conversations. We need to talk to each other much more skillfully, or else, frankly, we're lost. I don't think we're going to clean up this planet with only white people doing all the work and Black people standing by and cheering. That's, or vice versa, for that matter. I think we're in the same boat together, and we shouldn't presume that the lifeboat is being commanded by any particular group. The durable movements are the ones that are inclusive. Those are the ones that stick around and long after the riverkeeper's gone.
Thank you so much for talking to us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Fred Tutman founded Patuxent Riverkeeper, for which he is riverkeeper and CEO. We've been talking about his work to involve more African Americans at the table to address environmental issues. Quick break, and then we hear how Blue Water Baltimore celebrates 10 years of environmental engagement and advocacy. I'm Sheila Gass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about environmental advocacy. Earlier, we heard from the Patuxent Riverkeeper about how they're engaging more African-American communities to have representation in discussions of air and water quality. Joining us now is Jen A. Osa, Executive Director of Blue Water Baltimore. The nonprofit is celebrating 10 years this month in environmental engagement, education, and waterway restoration. Welcome to On the Record, Jen.
Thanks so much for having me, Sheila.
Tell us about Blue Water Baltimore. It was a merger of several organizations?
Yes. So a little more than 10 years ago, Baltimore City and County had five separate organizations that were doing similar work. We had watershed associations for the Jones Falls, Gwynns Falls, Herring Run, and Baltimore Harbor. And we had the Baltimore Harbor Waterkeeper. And through the work of some folks in our funding community, as well as representatives from each of those boards, we basically came together and decided that we could be stronger than the sum of our parts by merging those five small organizations. And Blue Water Baltimore is the product of that merger. And we're celebrating 10 years this year.
So tell me some of the notable accomplishments from these 10 years.
One of the things that I'm proudest about is the fact that Blue Water Baltimore has one of the most robust water quality monitoring programs of the Gwynns Falls, Jones Falls, and the Tidal Patapsco River. We take monthly measurements of a variety of water quality parameters, and we share that information publicly via our website. We share with the city and the county. We share with the State Department of Natural Resources and with academic researchers across the state who are interested in high quality, trustworthy data. So we're very proud of that. And just this past April, we were reporting on the collective 10 years worth of water quality data. And for the first time in 10 years, we were able to discern real trends in water quality. Some were improving, which is great news, and some that were not improving, which means we can scientifically tell where we need more restoration work.
You've done a lot with trees, right?
Yes, absolutely. So another thing that Blue Water Baltimore has done with a host of partners, neighborhood associations, other nonprofits, and the city and county governments themselves, is we have planted thousands of trees in neighborhoods, in parks, along our waterways, and in other public and private spaces. We've also worked with a variety of partners like churches and community associations to implement small-scale, what we call green stormwater practices that will help deal with and reduce some of that stormwater burden. Another thing that stands out in the past several years especially has been our focus on education and outreach and engagement of community members and residents of the Greater Baltimore region.
That's Jen A. Osa, Executive Director of Blue Water Baltimore, on the record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. This month, they're celebrating 10 years of environmental advocacy and education. Tell us more about your partners.
So we are really lucky that almost everything we do is in partnership. The partners that I think are just so invaluable to our work primarily come from our neighborhoods and our communities. So we have community leaders in places like Cherry Hill and Robert W. Coleman and Greater Mondawmin, Bel Air Edison, along the Stony Run, the Jones Falls, that really direct us in the work that we do. And so these communities have identified what their problems are or where they want trees or that trash is a growing issue. And we then work with those community leaders and those neighbors to create and plan and implement the interventions that they want. I would be completely remiss if I didn't also note that we have quite a few funders, folks like the Abel Foundation or the Franz Marek Foundation, the Department of Natural Resources, that help provide the funding for those trees or for those advocacy proposals.
Without some of the group activities you had planned being possible because of the pandemic, what can people do on their own to make a positive impact on water quality?
Two huge things that folks can do is to think about what they're doing in their own homes. So during the pandemic, lots of folks have been gardening or working on their landscapes. And we always recommend the use of native plants, because native plants, perennials, trees, and shrubs, they're already adapted to our climate. They don't need excessive watering or fertilizing or pesticide treatments. And so that means fertilizers and pesticides or chemicals won't inadvertently run off from our lawns or our homes. The other thing we've seen a lot of folks doing is getting out in nature. We recommend that folks bring a trash bag along with them and very safely pick up some trash along their favorite route or along their trail or in their neighborhood to help be part of the solution, but also allow you to help beautify your neighborhood and maybe convince a neighbor or a friend that they can be doing this kind of thing as well.
So June 30th, the last day of your celebratory month, a host of virtual events taking place as we speak for the Blue Water Baltimore 10th anniversary. Tell us what's going on.
So all day today, mostly on the hour or on the half hour, we have 11 of our staff members, including myself, that are going to be Facebook Live broadcasting from 11 sites around our region. And they're going to talk a little bit about why that site is important to them. It might be because it's a significant restoration project that we completed. It might represent the partnership that went into a particular project. Our waterkeeper is going to be Facebook Live posting from the water near the Inner Harbor. And then I'm going to be wrapping it up around 6 p.m. In my favorite park, Herring Run Park, to talk about why that location is important to me, but also to close out our celebratory month and report back on how generous some of our supporters have been over the course of the month.
And how does this 10-year milestone play into the significance for you, the significance of this event?
You know, I think 10 years is a relatively short time period for an organization. But I feel as though Blue Water Baltimore, the fact that we came together as separate groups and that our work is so reliant on partnerships, we've really been able to collectively accomplish a lot and raise awareness about some of these challenges in our environment across the Baltimore region. But I'm really optimistic that this signifies that we can do a whole lot more together in the next 10 or 20 years so that our kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews are going to inherit a much healthier environment, but also a greater sense of responsibility for maintaining our parks, our trees, our waterways, and our public spaces. And I think that for me has been a real reflection point over this month of celebration. I've sort of been looking at where we came from in 10 short years and where we've sort of set ourselves up for the next 10, 25, or even more time down the road.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you so much.
Jen A. Osa is Executive Director of Blue Water Baltimore. The nonprofit is celebrating 10 years of education and advocacy this month, and today they're hosting virtual events from locations throughout the city all day long. We have a link to that information and more at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us on the record. Join us again tomorrow. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.